History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we sure learn a lot, don't we? We're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Every year when the middle of February rolls around, I try to focus you back on something that happened this time of year. 77 years ago now, the Japanese-American community across our country holds a day of remembrance, because Executive Order 9066 happened, President Roosevelt issuing that decree in 1942 in the wake of the attack on Pearl Harbor, and it changed so many lives. We're going to hear from a man whose life was changed back then and hear how he overcame all of that today. 92-year-old Robert Uesaka of Clovis, California, our guest today. You weren't born here, you're born in Southern California, but very young age, your family moved to Arizona. And you're the youngest of four kids. Why did your family have to move out to Arizona?
My dad contracted a severe case of asthma, and the weather there was not good for his health, so the doctor advised him to move to a drier climate, which was Arizona. So he visited Arizona for a couple of weeks, and when he came back, he was in glowing health. So he just rapidly picked up all his belongings and with a family moved to Arizona.
So what was that like? In the 1930s, people say Salt River now, and they think of the baseball complexes for spring training. But what was out there in the 1930s, and what were your memories growing up in a farming family?
Well, we went there in 1927, and I was only 1 year old, so that period is, I can't remember. But then back in the 30s, Depression era was pretty tough. People were always in need. And growing up in that era, you know, your philosophy on life is much different than those of the young people today. Save what you could and utilize what you have. That was the mode of living in that era.
Well, and I'm wondering if maybe you have some examples of that, that maybe young people today would say, really? Did they really do that? Do you look back on some things that you did that didn't seem like a big deal then but might be now?
Well, being in, you know, in that era, as children, we had much more freedom than the children of today. We didn't have the fears that most of the parents have for their children today. We had more peace, and nobody bothered us as we roamed the countryside. We always lived in the country, and we're always a farming family. So basically, we didn't suffer as much as far as food and the bare necessities as some of the people in the cities. Most of our basic needs were always there, so we didn't suffer as much as some of the other families might have.
What all did you grow on your farm?
With strawberries, cantaloupe, and, produce and berries, most of the stuff that truck farming in those days.
But since you were the youngest, they didn't make you do anything around the farm, right?
No, I was the youngest. You know, in the 30s, I was only preteen, so there's not much I could do. But I remember how hard it was for not only our family, but for everybody. Like, farm labor was 10 cents an hour. And, they worked 7 days a week, 10 hours a day. They'd take $7 home. And still, they made a bare living with that. So things were difficult. But as a child, you don't realize how difficult it is for the parents.
Well, and if you can remember that child, that young boy, I'm sure you're influenced somewhat by your two older brothers and your older sister, but do you remember having ambitions, dreams, ideas of, hey, someday here's what I'm going to do?
Oh, yeah. I always wanted to become a doctor, and I was taking some of the courses and things, but then when Pearl Harbor happened and we were taking it to camps and everything, well, all that went out the window.
Well, I'd like to understand your life before that happened. Like you said, you're a teenager.
16
when Pearl Harbor happens. Going to school, had you ever experienced any kind of discrimination, or were you ever made to feel that you were different because your parents had immigrated from Japan?
Oh, yeah, constantly. You know, friends that you had prior to Pearl Harbor no longer were your friends. Everybody looked at you with a jaundiced eye. Even at home, when your telephone rang, somebody always picked up. It was party line. Somebody picked up to listen in on the conversation every time. And by law, we were restricted to not go too far from where you lived. But at the time, I was 16. So that was about the way life was at that point. But there was a lot of prejudice toward the Japanese in Arizona, Salt River Valley at that time. And there was a lot of problems.
What about before Pearl Harbor? Had you dealt with that much before, or did that really catch you off guard when that happened?
No, all this prejudice happened before Pearl Harbor. Some of the Japanese homes where people would throw homemade bombs against the house. I had a good friend that his house was bombed. They would open the gates to the irrigation water and flood your fields and stuff like that would happen. And if you had some vehicle parked near the ditch, they would push it into the ditch. Things like that. And we've one instance, there were five of us young, because I was a second grader at the time. They chased us. You know, they were high school kids. They chased us, and we were away from home. But we had BB guns, so we were able to get rid of them.
Well, we can laugh about it now, but I'm sure at the time, things like that were really upsetting to you. What maybe gave you stability or a sense of connection or someone to depend on when it seemed like so many people were against you?
Well, you know, not everybody. You had instances where people were, I guess, more tolerant toward us and all that. All through pre-Pearl Harbor and post-Pearl Harbor days, there were the missionaries that came from the different denominations. They were very friendly and very helpful. They brought stability in our lives. Like even after I left camp, we were in Colorado, and it was the missionaries there that really opened their doors for the evacuees and all that. So life became more normal.
What about December 7th, 1941? Do you remember how you found out what happened?
Oh, yeah. We didn't find out till later that evening because everybody was working on a Sunday to get ready for sending the produce to the market on Monday morning. So it wasn't until that evening we heard about it. At first, it was, you know, you wouldn't believe it. But then after you saw the headlines the following morning in the newspaper, it became a reality. I guess it affected each individual in a different way. Like, I was younger, so it wasn't that traumatic as it might have been for my parents. And for them, the war ended their time of being self-sufficient and everything. They were semi-invalid even before the war. But then after Pearl Harbor, their productivity was just cut off, and they never became productive after that.
Did you have to go to school the next day?
Oh, yes. We went to school until evacuation, where they had took us into camp.
Well, what was it like at school the next day, and how many Japanese-American students do you think there were in your school?
Oh, there might have been about less than a dozen. So there were instances where prejudice showed up. Like, we had one fellow that was a senior in high school. He was chosen to be king of the one of the ceremonies at the end of the school year. Well, the superintendent took that honor away from him. Of course, he didn't have to evacuate because he was on the other side of the line.
Well, explain that to me. So where you lived, there was a line of demarcation for who had to go in the camps and who could live quasi-free.
Yes, there's a main highway bisecting Salt River Valley there. Everybody who lived on the south side of that highway would evacuate first, and then those who lived on the north side would follow eventually. But then it turned out that for some reason or other, the government chose not to take them into camp. So they got to stay there while we were in camp, and they never did have to go to camp. We heard rumors that they were running out of produce, and they were mostly produce farmers, so they needed them to grow the crops.
Well, I guess I should ask you this too, because now we look in hindsight, and you know, this is something you've lived with for more than 70 years, more than 75 years, and we know that this happened, that Japanese Americans on the West Coast were forced out of their homes, that in many cases they lost everything they had, and we'll hear about your family's story. But at the time, even after Pearl Harbor, even with the discrimination you dealt with, could you ever have imagined that the government would lock you all up behind barbed wire?
Well, that never occurred to us that would ever happen. You know, the Bill of Rights and everything gives you that freedom, but then unfortunately, it can be taken away. That's what happened to us. But, you know, being 16, it doesn't hit you as hard and negatively as it would otherwise. If I were older, it would have been more serious. But then, you know, 16, you're still a kid yet, and these things really don't have a large impact on your life.
And so we have a sense of the scope of this. Before Pearl Harbor, before 9066, 3 months later, your family had this farm. How many acres do you think you were farming?
80 acres.
And your family owned that?
No. You know, my parents could never own property. They were prohibited by law and could not become citizens or own property. Even to rent the property, they had to get a third party to sign the lease. So, it was always a problem. But my dad would have liked to own property, but by law he couldn't.
Just because he was an immigrant from Japan.
Oriental.
That's what they called him then.
Yeah, from the Orient.
But he'd overcome some of those obstacles. You're leasing this land. You're farming 80 acres. As you said, that got you through the Depression with the food right there. And he was the family. You were supporting a family of six on this land. And all of that was taken away from you.
There were crops that could be harvested at that time, but then there was nobody to come forth and to buy it. So you just have to abandon it. And that's what we did. It was forced on, so you couldn't do anything about it.
And this was an incredible hardship for every Japanese-American family who got sent to a camp. In your family's case, they actually split your family apart. What happened there?
Well, my oldest brother, to conduct business, he went to the north side of the line, who had more freedom at that time. So he conducted the business for the produce being sold and all that. So he left. My dad was an enemy alien, so he was taken into a different camp by the FBI. They just came one day and told him he had to go to, and they picked him up and just took him. So that just left the three of us at home until the time we were evacuated into and put into the camps.
How did you handle that as a 16-year-old, to see your father taken away from your family just like that?
Well, there's not much you can do. You wish it didn't happen, but it did, and you just have to live with it. It was hard for the older, especially for my oldest brother and sister and my mother, but they carried on the work of the farm, and we had strawberries at the time and some other things, and they would continue harvesting until we left.
When your father was taken away by the FBI, how long prior to your going to the camp was that?
Well, 2 months. I think my dad was taken in March, if I remember correctly, and we were sent to the camps in May.
And I'm sure you had no idea what to expect, but what did you find when you got to that internment camp in Poston, Arizona?
Well, initially, you know, the Arizona people, there were roughly 250 of us that were taken into the camps initially. We were sent to a CCC camp in northern Arizona, a little town called Mayer. They had a little camp there, which they enclosed and made rooms there for the families to occupy. The kitchen was there and everything, so we stayed there for a couple months, and then we were sent to Poston.
What did it feel like to be a teenager and to be locked up in this camp with these other people that, you know, you've got a few family members, maybe you know some of the other folks? What was your day-to-day life like, and what was your outlook at that point?
Well, it's an experience that, you know, like most of the people that went to camp, we knew, because the Japanese people in Arizona, there were times when we had to band together, so we knew a lot of them. As far as for myself, it wasn't difficult at all, because, you know, you got other young people that are there. We had football games and different kind of things that you did. For me, it was more like an adventure.
You were the right age for that, I guess, huh?
Sure. You know, you're more carefree, and you don't have the responsibilities of worrying about the family and all that. So, sure, you thought about your father and all that who weren't there, because only four of us went to camp. My oldest brother was in Colorado, and my dad was in the different camp, so it was a little bit difficult for that in that respect.
Were you guys able to correspond with your father at all?
Oh, yeah, you could write letters, but then everything was censored. You'd get letters with blocked out things and all that. Portions of the letter would be blocked out if they didn't want us to know where he was and all that kind of stuff. Well, it was all blocked out. And I suppose they did the same to the letters we sent to him.
Which camp was he in?
Well, there's several of them. He was in Lordsburg. He was in Crystal City. There were several of them he was shifted around to.
Did you ever understand why?
No, No, it's you don't know what the government does with it, you know, when they take people in. So you just have to be patient and wait till you get a letter from him to let you know that he's okay.
So when they moved you from that first camp in northern Arizona down to Poston, then you're in a much bigger camp with a whole lot of Japanese Americans who they had forced out of California, right?
Oh, yeah. I never knew there were so many Japanese. We had people from all over California in the western states in Poston. You know, you got to know different people. There were a lot of problems, too. But then for us younger, you know, the young guys, we had our sport programs. We had baseball teams, softball teams, and all that. So it was a lot of fun.
I've seen some photographs, and I've read a lot about baseball, particularly in that camp and neighboring camps. It probably didn't look like the baseball fields that we see in that part of the country right now, though. What can you describe for us the setting or the fields you played on, and how much of a big deal that was to have the chance to play baseball there, or how big of a distraction or outlet that was?
Oh, yeah, well, that was one of the big outlets, you know, one of the things that without the sports and everything, you know, life in camp would have been real dull. Of course, you had your dances and church services and all that, but then sports was one of the big draws for the young guys. As far as the facilities, we had to create our own. They had empty areas in the camps, so you cleared the area and formed your own lines and created your own baseball field. And, you know, miraculously, the ball and the bats would come from someplace. Some people from outside the camp would donate it and send it in. And we have friends from Arizona that came in and visited us. And they would bring us some sports equipment, horseshoes and things like that, that they thought we might enjoy. So things like that was a bright part of what we experienced.
What position did you play?
Second base. I was a young kid, but, you know, most of the guys were older. There were a few of us younger guys on the team, but it was a lot of fun.
That experience was not unique to Mr. Uesaka. Baseball was a powerful lifeline for many in that same predicament. My friend Kari Yo Nakagawa of the Nisei Baseball Research Project has written a tremendous book about that called Diamonds in the Rough. I have a link to that online at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll hear more of Robert Uesaka's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.